Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 127, Interview with Rick Novi, and a review of X-Men First Class. This episode is brought to you by Clark's World Magazine. Kindle subscriptions now available.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding.
Oh, man.
And now, pods docked on a Zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. This is Sean Farrell.
This is Moses Sirigar.
This is Brent Bowen.
Today we are joined by science fiction author Rick Novi. And Rick and I talk about his new novel, Neanderthal Swan Song. A fascinating book. So the topics are all over the map from DNA, you know, a cloning of buried frozen organisms to Jurassic Park to the changes of publishing and all that good stuff. We also have a film review from Joshua Liu on X-Men First Class. And we have a short little news segment that we'll review near the end of the show, along with some feedback. But first, we do have a bit of news. You know, one of the things that we like to do is talk about what we have going on. And Moses is doing something that is really cool. Actually, he has a lot of cool things going on right now and in August. But Moses, what? Tell us about this new website that you have.
Thanks, man. It's called IndieAuthorRockstar.com, a little tongue-in-cheek, but the website is up, IndieAuthorRockstar.com. And, the website name is meant to be a little fun because it's kind of a fun thing. I'm trying to create a community of people who are interested in indie publishing, self-publishing. And one guy tweeted about it and said, this is like American Idol for self-publishers. And, he said it's not a big deal yet, but it will be. So that was kind of nice for him to say. But it is kind of an interesting concept, so it might actually work. I was trying to come up with a creative solution for how to help readers find good self-published, indie published books, and how to help deserving authors get recognition and attention and support for their books. Because now you've got all this big flood of books coming out, ebooks by new authors, and it's going to become a pretty big sea pretty quickly. It is already. So this is just one little way of trying to help some people find some deserving authors. And the way it works is the authors participate in it for free. Each author can submit just one book to our site. And I do approve the book for the site. Mainly I look at the cover. If it's got a cover that I don't think is up to a relatively professional standard, then I don't include it in the site. Okay. Which is a way of trying to, filter out some books that maybe aren't that great. I mean, you never know. Of course, it could be a fantastic book with a terrible cover, but I only have so much time, and so if the cover doesn't look that great, then sorry, that's not going to work for us. The first time through, I only had to kick out about 15% of the books, maybe 20% at most, based on the covers. So most people get in.
You have to have something to go by,
There are a few other standards that are proprietary, but the cover is the main one. So, I look at the covers and I say, okay, I think this can work here. And in a nutshell, what we do is every month we have six new authors that people can choose from and check out their books. And it's sort of like an audition. You have six books auditioning to be the indie author rock star of the month for the next month. The authors who are on the site, who have submitted a book to the site, they each get one vote. And at the end of the month, they vote and they choose which of the six books the authors want to say, this is our rock star author for the next month. And then the next month, you have one rock star out of the six. And you also get a whole slew of six new books to check out to choose the next month. So it's an ongoing monthly thing. Mm-hmm. And if you're the rock star of the month, then the idea is that it's a community of authors who want to do, you know, very genuine, very authentic, very ethical things to support that month's rock star author. So you might do things like, hey, read their book, tell your friends about the book, tweet about it, Facebook about it. You know, maybe have the person do a guest post on your blog, or interview them, or, you know, help them out in some little way. So the idea is to try to get hundreds of people focused on this one author for that month and see if we can get that person to go to a whole new level of success. You know, maybe get a bunch of sales and a bunch of promotion, and the community kind of gets behind that author for a month to try to see them succeed in a big way that they might not have been able to do without a huge community of support behind them. And I run around and try to get them some extra publicity. You know, I try to find some big blogs that might talk about what we're doing on our site and support us that way. So that's kind of how it works. It's this is our first month. So we have chosen our 6 books. You can go to our site if you're hearing this in July, and you can look at the 6 books. And only the people who submitted last month can vote. So we have 80 authors who submitted last month. They get to vote. But then next month we'll do it all over again. So it's also going to be a blog about independent publishing and reading, and, you know, hopefully it'll be a fun blog for people to hang out at too.
That's awesome.
Now, Moses, do you because you mentioned all the books that have been submitted over the past month, do you create kind of a library of all the submissions, or and just identify the 6 as the ones that are up for Rockstar of the Month?
Yep. Every month we are going to have a dedicated page that you can always find the 6 submissions of the month. So there's always a, you know, a link and a page on the site that you can find the monthly 6 contestants. And also there'll be a page for the monthly rock stars. You can always go there and find the rock star of the month. And initially I was setting up a real pretty thing with all the submissions, and I had the book covers and, you know, Amazon affiliate links and that kind of stuff too. And then it kind of crashed on me and I didn't have time to fix it. And I just said, okay, I'm just going to list the books. So there's a list of 80 books there. And, you know, that allowed me to just at least have them there, because what I did is I recorded myself, you know, going to random.org and choosing randomly, you know, the books, so you can cross-reference the numbers that I picked with the numbers that are on the site, you know, by the book. So I guess we're not going to end up doing a whole lot to feature the submissions if you don't end up ever as one of the 6 monthly contestants, but they'll, you know, they're on there. But that's, I guess, you know, ideally we'll get hundreds of books doing this. We had the first month we had 80, and if this keeps going, hopefully it'll keep growing. So eventually, hopefully it'll be a thing that'll really matter and be really interesting. Mm-hmm. Just being one of those 6 authors is a cool thing too, because you'll automatically get a bunch of people looking at your book if you're one of those 6. And people will be checking out the samples of your book, you know, because you can, for a Kindle book, you'd look at a sample whether you have a Kindle or not. If you just have a computer, you can read the samples of the books. And just that alone will get attention for those people. And it is random. So it's totally fair in that respect. You know, we're not pretending to find the best books of the site, but it's a fair, totally democratic, totally random thing. So, you know, no one's going to be accused of bias, for example, which I like.
You just started this, but 12 months from now, will you have your first indie rock star of the year?
Yes, we will. Yeah. I think what we're going to do is every year we'll take the 12, we'll have to figure out how the schedule works, but we'll look at, you know, 12 people who've won monthly, and then we'll have a vote with all the authors who participate on the site, and we'll let them choose an award, you know, the rock star of the year. And that'll be a reward that'll mean something, I think, because your peers vote on it. We could open the voting to the public, but then you get into all kinds of potential problems, like people creating, you know, sock puppet accounts to stuff the ballot box.
Right.
And by doing it this way, you pretty well get around that kind of shady stuff.
So, Moses, with the random nature of the way you guys select the 6, how much will the people that are actually selecting the Rockstar of the Month have in the way of actually looking at the book over the course of that month?
Right. Well, they're announced on the first of any given month. Next month, it'll be August 1st. And you have until the last day of the month, essentially, to vote. So you do have the entire month. And I think what most people will probably do is they'll probably read the samples of the books for Kindle. And then let's say maybe they find 2 or 3 that they really like. You know, maybe they buy those books and read those books and check them out. So, I mean, like, that's what I'm doing this month, is I'm reading all the samples and figuring out from there, you know, if I have a really clear sense of which one is going to be the winner, I'll try to read that book and just make sure the rest of the book seems good. But if it was really tough and I had like a tough call between two or three, I would try to buy and read those books that month, at least get deep enough into the story. And, you know, obviously it'd be great if we had, you know, even more time to do it. But keeping it monthly seems like a good pace for it, keeps things moving. So, it's kind of up to each author how much work they want to put into making that selection, but the idea is that they do put in some work to try to see the books that seem like they're the most deserving.
All right, man, very cool. IndieAuthorRockstar.com is the URL. Check it out, and we will continue to talk about this as the months go on, because it's a great site, it's a great idea, and Moses is doing a great service to authors who are looking for an audience and who deserve an audience. So, wait a minute, is this going to take away your time from us, though? Okay, that's it. Don't go to the website at all.
just a little blogging here and there.
all right. I don't want to lose you,
Sean. Reel it in. It's gonna be okay, brother.
I'm all emotional after recording that promo with you guys just a few minutes ago. All right, let's take a break, and we'll be back with Rick Novy, who is an independent published author. There you go. Back in a second. For years, the Hugo Award-winning Clark's World magazine has brought readers the very best in science fiction and fantasy fiction, articles, and artwork, both online, in podcasting, and via their anthology series Realms. Now, they offer something new: Kindle subscriptions. Use your Kindle to take Clark's World everywhere you go, or use the Kindle app on your iPad or your computer. But check this out. Best of all, if 500 readers sign up for Kindle subscriptions by October, Clark's World will use that money to expand the magazine, and they will publish additional fiction every month. So sign up today using the image in the show notes, or go to clarksworldmagazine.com. Kindle subscriptions. Go get one. For Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, this is Sean, and now I am joined by Rick Novy. Rick is a professor of mathematics living in Phoenix, a member of the SFWA. He's had numerous short stories published, and his new novel is Neanderthal Swan Song. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So I have many, many questions for you, lots to talk about. But first, let's talk about your book. Can you tell us a little bit about Neanderthal Swan? That's hard to say. Neanderthal Swan Song.
Yeah, it's the story of, well, it starts in Greenland, which is kind of a strange place for it to start, because the Neanderthals never actually wandered over that far east. But I've got a backstory that explains that one of these days I'll put out. It starts there, and it's kind of literally stumbled upon, and from there there's some political intrigue, and an American anthropologist gets involved and ends up with an illicit tissue sample, and ultimately clones the Neanderthal. So about the first third of the book, quarter third of the book is that part of the story, and then the balance of the book is the story of this Neanderthal and his life in the modern world.
Obviously, I don't want to give away too many details of the book, but does the book deal with the Neanderthal, you know, learning English or some language and trying to fit in with society, or is he mostly kind of, or she, mostly kind of, I don't know if it's he or she, kept in a lab? What's the setting in which the Neanderthal finds him or herself?
The Neanderthal grows up in a lab, and it turns out that, and it's a he, it turns out that he's a brilliant mathematician and a very intelligent person. Ultimately, he breaks out of the laboratory at age 18 when he's considered an adult and breaks out on his own. And he really doesn't know what his place in society is, but he does want to make a last contribution for his kind, which kind of brings you to the title, sort of a swan song for the Neanderthal. And he struggles to find where he belongs. And so while he was still growing up, he studied several languages, including Japanese, and he ultimately ends up over in Japan, where interestingly enough, he finds more acceptance than he did here, which is kind of unexpected, but it's explained.
So it sounds like it's kind of a coming-of-age story mixed in with the science.
In some ways, it's a coming-of-age story, yeah.
You mentioned that he's a brilliant mathematician, and as I said in your intro, you know, you're a mathematician. How did you use your expertise in writing the novel? What kind of math is there?
I don't go specifically into the mathematics. I'm more show him working on the mathematics. I don't think very many people actually want to read a book of fiction and have it turn into a math textbook. And I also should point out that I'm not a mathematician by trade. I'm an adjunct professor at the community college, so I teach part-time in mathematics. But it comes into play. I'm actually, my first love is more physics than mathematics, and one of the main characters, in fact, the point of view character through the first part of the book is a geophysicist. He's the one that actually discovers the body, and he ends up being the Neanderthal boy's father figure through the probably the first 10 years of his life until, if I say any more, there's spoilers, so I won't go there.
Okay, this is totally off topic, but I have to ask you this, because I don't know anything about math. I was really bad at it, but I've always wondered, when you're watching science fiction shows, and you just pick whatever show you want at random, I'm thinking of like a Stargate or something, and they have all these equations written out on a board somewhere. Is that all just a bunch of crap, or is it actual real equations on there?
I've seen both. I've seen situations where it's total gibberish, and I've also seen situations where at least they have the basic concepts right. For instance, when you walk into Star Trek Next Generation in the engine room, the warp engine is cylindrical, and they talk about Bessel functions, and so at least they have the geometry correct for the function they're talking about there. But it really depends on how much, I guess, the technical advisors and how much the actual filmmakers know about the subject.
Thank you for answering my tangent there. So coming back to our Neanderthal character, science fiction, it's a great genre to, you know, look at our world through a different perspective or through someone else's eyes. And, you know, certainly you have that here. You have an outsider. And I'm wondering how much exploring of our world, whether it's our society or politics or our culture, do we experience through the Neanderthal?
I hadn't really thought about it that way, because when I write, I pretty much put myself into the character, and I'm in the character's mind and using their eyes, so to speak. It's near future, but I've extrapolated a little bit more decay of American society, so it's not exactly the Renaissance place that it has been since World War II. It's crumbling a little bit. The American society is not what it once was, which is part of what the Neanderthal sees, and maybe it's the motivation behind the people who cloned him in the first place. I don't know if that answers the question. I hadn't really thought about that before.
Is he cloned by the Americans? I know the American gets the sample.
Yeah, he's cloned by the Americans in conjunction with one Greenlander who... The politics in Greenland, I'm positing that Greenland has won its independence from Denmark, and so Greenlandic politics, although there's not a large population, the important players in that country are very powerful but with very short arms, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So in the realm where they have control, they have almost absolute control to underhandedly basically do whatever they want, and anybody who gets in their way they can take care of. The Greenlandic anthropologist who becomes involved, who is actually an expert in Inuit cultures, he has, you know, minimal knowledge of Neanderthals in the first place, but for political reasons is involved. He sort of rebels against that eventually, and he's actually the one who provides the tissue sample.
The evolution, if you will, of American society. Can you touch on a little more detail on what that looks like in the book?
In some ways, it's a little bit of a magnification of what things are today. The point of view character early on, Phil Markey, who is the geophysicist who discovers the Neanderthal, gets to experience the paparazzi as they discover who he is and what role he played. The media plays some central roles in the story, on and off. Not pivotal roles so much, but just they make appearances because they would. And so I kind of amplify that in some areas. But in other areas, I've got to push them to the background. Otherwise, that's all you'd see. There's also some mention of global warming in there, and that character mentions through internal monologue some opinions that he has on it, but he doesn't really get into a discussion with it with anybody. I do show, as the Neanderthal gets older and as we get farther out from today, I show a little bit more decay in some areas of California. Part of it is set in Silicon Valley area, and as you well know, Palo Alto right now is a pretty a fairly comfortable place for people to live. People who have decent incomes and decent standards of living live in that area. But I show a certain shopping center that is pretty posh today, or at least the last time I was there, pretty much boarded up and abandoned. And a dangerous street gang now resides there. So there's been a little bit of changes in society itself. But, I mean, it still largely reflects the America we have today with just a little bit of magnification of problems.
Another aspect of the novel, let's talk about the cloning for a second here. I love stories like this. It kind of reminds me of like Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park or John Varley's Mammoth. Of course, those are dealing with animals. But how close is our technology to being able to accomplish these feats?
In the novel, let me start off by saying that Jurassic Park was kind of a motivation for this novel. I was working at a company in Phoenix, and over lunch I was walking through the park, as I often did in those days. And I was thinking about Jurassic Park and some other ideas that I had, and it just finally hit on me that I couldn't believe that nobody had written a story that somebody had cloned a Neanderthal, or maybe somebody has, I just haven't seen it. But it certainly isn't something that's making headlines the way Jurassic Park did. So I started there, and I started looking into it. Most of the cloning activity that happens in the novel happens off-screen, but I did look into a little bit of the cloning technology. And I mean, the basic premise of cloning is fairly simple. You take a cell and replace the nucleus with the nucleus of the desired animal, and boom, there it goes. I mean, the rest is just engineering. But I'm trying to remember what the process is that they use. I think it was called the Honolulu process. There are others that would be a lot better to speak to the actual cloning process than I am. I'm a physicist, not a biologist. One of the reasons that I kept a lot of that off screen was just because I don't have an expertise in that area, and I really like to try to avoid as many scientific mistakes as possible. On the other hand, you know, Dolly the sheep, right? We've done that. That's probably 10 years old already. So if we can clone a living animal and we can find viable tissue for something that's extinct, I don't see that it's that much of an extrapolation to be able to take something that resembles the current processes we have and extend it in that direction.
Did you use any frog DNA in your...
I didn't use any frog DNA, no. Yeah, he doesn't start as a tadpole, and he doesn't have gills through the first 2 months of the embryonic stage.
All right, just checking. The Jurassic Park inspiration, I had to ask, you know.
Yeah, the Jurassic Park, not so much an inspiration, because Crichton's scientists are... He's often anti-science fiction rather than science fiction, if that makes any sense. But in this case, it just was sort of more the germ of the idea came from a cross between Jurassic Park and thinking about Neanderthals. I think it was about the same time that Iceman was discovered, right around the same time, so all those came into play.
You mentioned something here about keeping some of those aspects off screen because you didn't want to get the science wrong. And I want to ask you about this. We recently had this conversation that lasted for a few episodes on the podcast, sort of analyzing why fantasy is selling better right now than science fiction is. And one of the things that came up quite a few times among our listeners was that, you know, science fiction has a higher learning curve, that's more difficult for readers to grasp some of the technical details. And then we had some authors on the show who are scientists, but they write fantasy. And one of them even said, "Is because I don't want to get the science wrong," and he's a scientist. How do you handle the presentation of scientific concepts and of just science in general in your work?
It really depends on the branch of science that we're talking about. If it's something that I'm fairly comfortable with, the astronomy, the physics, I have enough knowledge that I can take those pretty far, farther than probably the typical non-scientist science fiction writer would be able to take those. On the other hand, when we start talking about things like biology, chemistry, where I took a class, maybe I took a couple classes in high school. If you've heard my interview on another podcast, you know that I keep a variety of tropical fish, so I know a little bit about that area. But if it's something that I'm not real comfortable with how solid the science is, I will not bring it to the front of the stage. That's just basically the way that I handle it. And most of my science fiction, this is a little bit of an anomaly in terms of the branch of science that I'm actually writing about. Most of my science fiction is either it's going to be social science fiction or it's going to be more of a hard science fiction where the physics is in the foreground rather than another branch.
Hmm. When you're writing the your fiction that focuses on the physics, what you know well, how do you approach that where, you know, you may have readers who don't know anything about physics?
I try not to get into the technobabble, the techno-speak type of dialogue or discussion until after it's at least defined in the fiction. One of the things that I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, I'm going to go back to what you set up in terms of talking about science fiction versus fantasy. I don't know that the number of readers that can't understand science fiction is larger than those who can, or maybe those who don't want to put the effort into it as opposed to those who will. But I think a lot of the science fiction readers that don't know that they're science fiction readers are out there reading techno-thrillers. Because I've had some people that are techno-thriller fans that have read some of my material and have told me flat out they don't like sci-fi, but I like this. Mm. And I think the reason is that their perception of science fiction is from the television and from movies and not from the rich history that the genre has in dealing with different problems in a very intelligent manner.
Yeah, that was something that I can't remember what my take on it was, but we threw it out there on Facebook and Twitter, and the idea of science fiction just being harder to grasp kept coming up over and over again. And finally, someone mentioned, hey, fantasy's not so easy either when you have a massive magic system and all these characters that you don't know how to pronounce their names and and whatnot.
Yeah, it's a fallacy that fantasy is easier to write. I don't write much fantasy, but I do delve in there every once in a while. And, you know, you've got to have your laws of nature in that universe as consistent as you do in the science fiction side. It's just different, for lack of a better word, different physics that operates there. You know, it's a magic system rather than a fundamental force system, but it still has to be consistent, otherwise the story is not believable.
Right, exactly. And a lot of the fantasy novels I've been looking at lately have very scientific principles or systems behind their magic. Some of them even directly related to biology or physics, or it's almost not even fantasy in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and was it Clark that said that any advanced technology that's advanced enough is essentially magic? So,
yep.
Paraphrasing, but some people have taken that concept and run with it.
Well, the iPad looks like magic to me, so I.
Yeah, it's a magic printing press for money. As soon as they start, they start iterating the generations every year, so you've got to buy a new one.
So I'm just gonna wait. I'm gonna wait till the 20th version comes out. By then, there'll be something better anyway.
There's nothing wrong with chasing technology from a couple of generations behind it. It's a lot cheaper.
That's what I do. Exactly right. Get it refurbished. It's a third of the price. I was listening to your interview. You were recently on the Jack Mangan Deadpan podcast, and I'll put a link in the show notes for this so everyone can go check that out as well. And you were talking about an anthology you edited called 2020 Visions. And in that, you mentioned that for the anthology, you had an open submission period, and you had a hard time finding positive science fiction stories that were depicting life just 10 years from the future, because this was published in 2010. But why is it that sci-fi seems to have this tendency toward, dystopian sensibilities, I guess is the way I'll state it?
Yeah, that's a question that I've thought about before, and it might be as simple as an explanation as that positive outlook stories or stories that end on a positive note are harder to write.
Hmm.
I'm not sure if that's the case or not. I mean, there's a lot of popularity in the dark fiction, sure. I mean, especially in the younger crowd. You know, back in the day when we were doing Dungeons and Dragons, when it was just the three books or still in the box, everybody wanted to be the chaotic evil characters. Well, I don't think that's what Gary Gygax intended, but they're maybe more fun, at least not superficially more fun at first. But then you start thinking about it, and why are the lawful good or even the chaotic good characters more fun for maybe those players that have a little bit more depth of character? And I think it's because they're harder to play. It's harder to play within a rule system where you have ethics or you have morals, depending on whether you're coming from a secular or a theological direction. It may just be as simple as that. I'm not sure. Hmm. I know that a lot of my fiction tends to have a positive ending. Not all of it. Jack mentioned in that podcast one that I shared on his deadpan maybe a year or two ago that was pretty negative. But that's an outlier for me. I don't know why. Maybe I like to just have hope and hope that things will get better than they are. I know you look in Washington and things look pretty bleak, and every time you turn around, you know, a different politician is showing their true colors on Twitter.
That was a nice way to put that.
And then you wonder, you know, people say that, you know, good people don't run for office because they don't want to be destroyed, and so you get what you vote for, and, you know, and that's why there's seems to be no common sense in Washington. But on the other hand, you turn around and you get somebody every once in a while, like Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, some would say Ronald Reagan, some would say Barack Obama. I'm not going to voice an opinion on any specific politician right now, but every once in a while you get somebody that maybe accidentally gets into office or maybe is a better person than they think they are.
So
I like to have a positive outlook for humanity.
Very good. Awesome. Well, I think we need more science fiction that does have a positive outlook. And my personal opinion is I think if we did have more, and I don't mean like touchy-feely kind of stuff, but if we had some more that was a little more positive, maybe we could, you know, grow the readership a little bit. That might attract some different readers.
Yeah, and if you think about it, though, I mean, 50 years ago, we've come a long way, American society and globally, in just attitudes towards other people. We've solved some problems. Some new ones have come up, but, you know, we'll solve those eventually. And science fiction is one of the vehicles, hopefully, that can help make that happen.
And something else you mentioned on the Deadpan podcast, you mentioned that your first novel attempt was a Star Trek novel, and so was mine, so we have something in common here.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
Yes, it was. So, okay, was yours an original, or what was your TNG? What was yours?
No, this was the original series. I was writing this back in high school, so
okay.
That was before Next Generation. I think it was before Star Trek the Motion Picture, even.
Oh, okay.
So it's a while ago. I wish I could find that manuscript. I'd post it online and get some good laughs out of it.
Yeah, I know. I wrote mine in a little binder. I was in seventh grade, and it was TNG. And all I can remember is I tried to put everything cool in there. So it had like a saucer separation, the Picard maneuver, the Borg. It was just like anything that my 13-year-old mind thought was cool had to be in there.
Yeah, this was the time before the Romulans really were exploited in terms of using the race in other stories, because, you know, you had the three seasons, the Romulans showed up in, what, two or three episodes?
Right.
One of them was really cool, you know, the one that was based on the submarine movie. And then the other ones were, you know, they were fine, too. I mean, the one where Kirk gets surgically altered and starts looking like his first officer, that was a fun one. But their society really hadn't been, at that time, expanded upon. And it really wasn't until the later shows and the movies that it was defined in the movies that they and the Romulans and the Vulcans were really one and the same. It
Right.
happened back then. So So I was playing with the Romulans then. In retrospect, I like my Romulans better than the actual Romulans.
Well, yeah, if I remember correctly, their first TNG episode, season one or season two, the Romulans make an appearance in their, you know, starship is twice the size of the Enterprise. It's funny because it seems like they got smaller as TNG went on.
I really liked that they didn't have warp drive, or if they did, it was very minimal warp drive, but they had these plasma torpedoes that could, you better run.
Right, exactly.
I thought that was pretty cool.
And they had kind of been isolated for 70 or 80 years. No one had heard
right.
from them. Yeah.
You know, and then they come along with the movie. The new one that just came out. Or actually, I'm trying to remember what it was now. Didn't they encounter the Romulans in Star Trek Enterprise? And they weren't supposed to know what they looked like then, if you look at the canon in the original series. But yet, they broke canon, so...
I don't remember if they were... I can't recall much of Enterprise.
Yeah, well, I'm sure somebody that's listening to this will.
Yeah, we'll get some emails about it.
They'll let us know if I'm right or wrong.
Okay, now we've really gotten off the topic of your work, but so this novel, this is your first published novel, and I know you're keenly aware of the rapidly changing publishing industry. So why did you decide to go the indie route with this book?
When I had finished this novel, I started shopping it around to agents and to traditional publishers. This was 4 or 5 years ago, and I entered a period of my life where basically everything was going wrong. And very high stress. It involved the day job I had at the time. It involved geriatric care of a family member. And, you know, of course, anytime you have got kids, that's always a stressor right there. Added that all together, and the writing petered off. The writing that I was doing wasn't very good at during those years. And the novel, while I shopped it to maybe 10 or 12 agents back in those days, when I lost the stress, the causes of the stress, I started looking at the novel again, and the landscape has changed so radically in the last 2 years, and especially in the last year, that I didn't really see the benefit of going the traditional publishing route, because, you know, our first novel is always hard to get out the door anyway, and with this first novel being 4 to 5 years behind how my writing skills have developed, I didn't really think it was worthwhile to chase after that. You know, and then you've got the stories that are circulating around by people like Mike Stackpole, people like Dean Wesley Smith, and Catherine Rush, about contract shenanigans. And I don't know the veracity of the stories because I haven't seen a contract. I'm just taking them at their word. And I haven't talked to publishers and gotten their side of stories. But there's so many stories out there that are corroborating with each other. Mm-hmm. And you do see new business models forming in the agents' offices. And I'm really not comfortable with where things are going. You know, a lot of writers don't have the technical chops to handle the electronic files that are required to do electronic self-publishing. And I do have those chops. It's not hard to put these things together, and especially anymore where you've got software that'll do all the heavy lifting for you. You really just have to touch up the files and then just send them up to Amazon and pretty much done. I don't really see where I get the benefit of using any of these services anymore, because I can put out a product that's just as good at a fraction of the cost and certainly quite a bit faster.
And, you know, you're going to be writing more books, so if the landscape right. becomes more favorable, you can always go the traditional route later on, you know?
I don't see any reason why writers can't, you know, play the field, so to speak. There's
right.
no reason you can't do indie work on one side, and if somebody is interested in a series that you're writing that's unrelated to the indie work, or even if it is related, you know, go that direction, too. There's no right. reason you can't do both. I think that in short fiction, it's still very worthwhile to be publishing traditionally in places like Analog, Asimov, and also the newer markets like Intergalactic Medicine Show and Clark's World and the other online magazines. Because short fiction is kind of like short film. You're not really writing it for the general public. You're writing it more for the industry and for reputation and networking type reasons. get known in the industry, it's not really, and the general public really doesn't read that much short fiction. They read novels. I think it's worthwhile playing in traditional public for short fiction, for sure, for those reasons.
For the business card aspect of it.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
Well, speaking of other work, what are you working on right now, Rick?
I've got a short story that I'm working on in collaboration with Ruth Nestvold, which is, we started probably 5 years ago, and it's I don't play very well with others, and so it wasn't a very smooth experience, but the story is just so fantastic that neither one of us could let it go. That I'm working on. We're in our final revision stages on that. I think we'll probably be submitting that sometime before the end of the summer somewhere. And I don't want to jinx it, so I don't want to say any more. I've got another short story that I want to fix, and I've got a nonfiction article for an online aquarium magazine that I've already said that I would write. And then after that, I've got two semi-finished novels that I'm going to finish and get those up there. One of them I'm almost certainly going to self-publish. The other one I may shop around a little bit, but by the time I finish that, the landscape may have changed. I mean, it's changed so quickly that April 2010, I wrote a short ebook on how to create ebooks, and then I posted it up on my website for free under Creative Commons. And it basically goes into the nuts and bolts on how to create the files and upload them and that sort of thing. And it changed so radically in that space of time that while the information in there is still valid and you can still make the files that way, it doesn't touch on the software now that's available that you just push a couple of buttons and it creates it for you. Mm. And so things have become, that document became obsolete that quickly.
Right.
So in the 6-8 months it's going to take me to finish those two novels, I fully expect that the landscape is going to continue evolving, and I don't think anybody knows where it's going to end up.
And you've dabbled in podcasting in the past. Do you have any interest in podcasting any of your fiction?
I had thought seriously about podcasting Neanderthal Swan Song, but there's one issue that I ran into in that the story takes place in three countries, Greenland, the United States, and Japan. And especially in Greenland, when you're looking at not the Danish but the Greenlandic, there's a lot of things that I just simply don't know how to pronounce. So
right, right.
I've started that basically was a showstopper for me. I didn't want to get out there and completely slaughter the Greenlandic because, of course, somebody's going to listen to it that knows Greenlandic, you know, as soon as I do that. And then the Japanese aspects of it, I'm not real comfortable with that pronunciation either, and there's a lot more people that know that pronunciation than certainly than Greenlandic. So I decided to serialize it on my blog, and I've been putting up a chapter a day from the beginning of June, and that's going to go, I think it goes through about the 13th of August or something like that. And then I'll leave that up there until the end of August and then pull it down.
Okay.
So I've taken kind of the back road in that route. But in the future, yeah, I certainly may do some podcasting of... You certainly can't argue with the success Scott Sigler's had. So I'm certainly trying to follow in his footsteps. Can't be called a mistake, I don't think.
Well, folks, you can find out more about Rick at ricknovy.com. That's NOVY.com. Everything you need is there. But, of course, come to our website. There will be links in our show notes so you can buy Rick's book. Unfortunately, we've only had this interview set up for about, 48 hours? So.
Something like that, yeah. I just want to also point out that there's a discount code. Anything that's purchased from my website, if you put in the discount code podcast, all caps, that it gives 50% off, and that's good through the end of August.
Discount code podcast. Awesome. Rick, is there anything else you want to mention while we're on that I didn't ask?
Fish punk.
What? Fish punk?
That doesn't mean anything to you. Yeah, I've got this idea that's going to be... It's probably going to be a parody of steampunk, which is going to be fish-powered equipment and society. Fish punk. I've already actually got a small press interested in doing an anthology, but I've got to come up with the rule book for the world and that sort of thing. So,
oh, I love it. That's awesome. All right.
That's coming up at some point.
Well, you'll have to keep us informed what happens with that. That sounds cool.
I certainly will.
Well, Rick, it's been awesome having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
Hello there once again to everyone in Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing Land. My name is Joshua Liu, and Sean has graciously and magnanimously invited me back to do another review for his podcast. So this week, we take a look at X-Men First Class. Now, this 2011 superhero action movie is the fourth movie in the X-Men film franchise and is a prequel to the first and second movie. Directed by Matthew Vaughn of Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, Layer Cake, and Kick-Ass fame, this movie stars the likes of James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, Footloose Bacon, January Jones, Rose Byrne, Jennifer Lawrence, and many more, and is loosely, very loosely based on the 2006 eight-issue comic miniseries of the same name. Now, set in the 60s, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, this mixes real-world events and comic book storytelling as the life of a young Charles Xavier, played by James McAvoy, a man born of privilege, who also has the power to read and control minds, intersects with a young Eric Lencher, played by Michael Fassbender, a man born of heartache and pain from his experiences growing up in a German concentration camp in Auschwitz, and who has the power over all metal. They must team up and band together a group of similar-minded mutants, the next stage of evolved humans, in order to stop another mutant named Sebastian Shaw, played by Footloose Bacon, from creating a nuclear holocaust. Can the dream of Charles Xavier of mutants and humans coexisting become reality, or is Eric Lencher right, and mutants must rise up to defend themselves from the humans who fear and will one day want to destroy mutant kind forever? Now, X-Men First Class had a lot going against it, mainly because of the fact that the last two X-Men movies, X-Men's Last Stand and X-Men Origin Wolverine, were unbelievable piles of garbage, which cannot be argued, and which, by the way, this movie, X-Men First Class, totally reboots those last two movies out of X-Men continuity, so bravo. But yeah, public sentiment after the last two X-Men movies has greatly devalued the X-Men property, and this showed in the opening weekend box office totals, which were a respectable 55.1 million domestic box office draw, making it the top grossing movie of the week. However, it also opened up with the worst opening of an X-Men movie. People are scared after the last two, because rightly so, we live in a world of sequels providing diminishing returns. However, my God, fear not, true believers, X-Men First Class lives up to the hope of a great X-Men movie. This is how you make a superhero movie. It has the heroics, it has the action, but it takes up so much time building the world and the characters that these mutants no longer feel like cardboard, cliched superheroes, but feel like living and breathing people that you root for and want to root for, and this is what makes this movie, this prequel, so successful. At the root of this movie is the relationship between Charles Xavier and Eric Lencher, and their differing set of beliefs that leads these two friends to come at odds time and time again as Professor X and Magneto in the future. It's the age-old debate of nature versus nurture, of Charles growing up with wealth and privilege and how that shapes his views and his heart, and of Eric, who grew up in a concentration camp during World War II, who watched his family die in front of his eyes, who was experimented on for years by the Nazis to unlock the key to the mutant gene. He only thirsts for revenge as he seeks down every Nazi currently living under an assumed identity, and this shapes his views on humanity because he's seen the ugly side of prejudice and hate and how that can warp people's views, and how he sees a future with the same thing happening to his new family, the family of mutants, and he will do anything in his power to stop another holocaust. McAvoy and Fassbender are amazing here. Their chemistry, their friendship is fantastically well done, but it was Fassbender that stole the whole movie. He has the harder role and in a lot of ways the more important role to play. You feel he's Magneto and you understand why he becomes Magneto. Fassbender is really turning into one of the better actors out there. And now, to be fair to McAvoy, Fassbender has the cooler character beats, the cooler role to play. Now, director Matthew Vaughn has taken his experience from doing quote-unquote serious films like Layer Cake and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and married it to the insanity of Kick-Ass, crafting a style of storytelling that is so sure-handed that you'll be amazed that this is a comic book movie. He really has such a wonderful eye for setting, for acting, for character moments that with this movie in Kick-Ass, he has become one of the top directors to go to for realistic style comic storytelling. Well, as realistic as a comic book movie can be. The special effects here are pretty amazing, from teleportation to explosive kinetic energy to flight. It's all laid bare and impressive here. However, it was Magneto's use of his powers. Now, this isn't giving anything away since it's in the trailers, but when Eric pulls the submarine out of the ocean, lifting it in the air with just the pull of his hand and concentration, wow, that is one of the most beautiful action set pieces that I've ever seen. Now, let's talk a little bit about the acting. I've already talked about McAvoy and Fassbender, so how about some Footloose? Kevin Bacon is pretty fantastic as the villainous Sebastian Shaw, who was the main villain of the X-Men as the leader of the Hellfire Club when I began reading the comic. all those many, many years ago, sadly. But yeah, he plays evil so well and a bit over the top. However, the main two female leads, January Jones as Emma Frost and Jennifer Lawrence as Mystique, were unbelievably weak. To be fair to Jennifer Lawrence, her character Mystique was not written particularly well, and so she really didn't get to do or say much besides, you know, really cliche lines like "Mutants Unite" or whatever rhetoric she keeps repeating. And, you know, this is a slight step out of her pretty masterful performance in Winter's Bone. But yeah, now with a handful of movies under January Jones's belt, which I have all seen because, well, she looks like January Jones, but yeah, she can act her way out of a mannequin, and, you know, Mad Men is a perfect role for her since she has to play a character with no emotions, but yeah, she really can act. So yeah, this movie has so many moving parts, so many characters, and so much storyline, and yet, surprisingly, it holds up really well. Besides some mediocre dialogue and acting, everything in this film works like you hope a blockbuster movie should. This is a modern pop movie in every sense. It's fast-paced, if slightly long in the end, and hopefully this will make movie viewers forget that X-Men Last Stand and X-Men Wolverine Origins ever existed. X-Men First Class also does something I always find incredibly difficult: bring intense suspense to a story where the viewer already knows the outcome. We know Professor X ends up in a wheelchair, and he and Magneto become tragic sworn enemies, two sides of the same coin. We've seen the future in the X-Men movies, yet this film is able to build so much suspense throughout. It's a true feat of filmmaking, and I think it's more than fair to say this is the best of the X-Men movies. Definite recommend, definite must watch, even if you aren't a comic book fan. Okay, once again, I would like to thank Sean for inviting me back to his show. I hope everybody enjoyed it. Now, if you want to follow me and hear more of my reviews, I host a film podcast called Cinema Cafe Podcast, which can be found at cinemacafepodcast.blogspot.com or on iTunes. Search Cinema Cafe Podcast, three words. Thanks for listening, and happy movie watching.
So, guys, Joshua really liked the X-Men film. You've both seen it. I haven't. What do you think? Do you agree?
I really liked it. I really did. And I'm pretty hard critic on Hollywood movies. I had a good time. I thought it was just a fun, solid story and can't really complain.
I thought it personally was the best of all the X-Men movies. And the way Magneto in particular was portrayed in the course of the movie, I think if you had watched any of the other Hollywood versions of the movie, it's all about the macro strength of his ability. And in this, there was very much a sociopath melded with his abilities and a very personal nature in the way he took out the enemy, which was, you know, it was cringeworthy. Let's just put it that way.
Okay.
So the portrayal is a dynamite movie too. Great sense of history. It was almost like an alt history, mm-hmm. in addition to being a great superhero movie and team superhero movie. Great alt history as well. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. All the major roles were really well cast. The acting was quite good, I thought, for being, you know, a superhero movie. It was great.
Okay, good. I will check it out. I will. And I like the other X-Men movies, but I just don't go to the movie theater, so it takes me 6 to 8 months to catch up with what's coming out. But there you go. X-Men, I always want to say X-Men with class, and I think it's because of Dragon Page with class, and you guys heard that podcast?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, neither here nor there, as they say. So let's introduce a little new segment that I decided to roll out, and I don't know if Brent or Moses are going to like this idea, but I just put it in here, which is our recommended book of the week. So what we're just going to do is, whether it's from press releases that get sent in to us or things that we have noticed that have come out or that are going to come out in the next week or two, we're just going to throw one out there randomly that looks interesting, and we have a very different book for our first one.
I like the idea, Sean. I think it's great.
Thank you.
So the full title of this one is The Thackeray T. Lambshead Cabinet of Curiosities, Exhibits, Oddities, Images, and Stories from Top Authors and Artists. This is a release from HarperCollins in mid-July. It's an oversized hardcover edited by Anne and Jeff Vandermeer. So the Cabinet Anthology, it's a history of the 20th century told through the secret life of artifacts, an art book with over 70 images and a cornucopia of the best of modern fantasy, including original work by over 85 amazing creators. Contributors include Holly Black, Ted Chiang, Lev Grossman, China Mieville, and Michael Moorcock, just to name a few. Here's the idea. after the death of the famous Dr. Thackeray T. Lambshead at his house in Whimpering on the Brook, England, a remarkable discovery is unearthed, the remains of an astonishing cabinet of curiosities. In keeping with the bold spirit exemplified by Dr. Lambshead and his exploits, HarperCollins now proudly presents fully illustrated highlights from the Doctor's cabinet, including exciting stories of adventure and reproduced museum exhibits.
We'll have the link in the show notes. And this is actually a follow-up to another one that they did, which was Dr. Oh, what was the title? The Thackeray T. Lambshead Chronicle of Fake Diseases or something like that. I can't remember the title. And when we had Anne Vandermeer on the show, what was it, back in episode 102, I believe, she talked about this, and she talked about the other anthology. So it's very different. It's a lot of fun, so check it out. All right, feedback time. We got some emails to get to. Rusty wrote in and wants to know if we really said that we're going to do a live call-in show. And the answer, of course, is yes, we want to do that. And Rusty, you are on the short list. So we just need three other participants, really. If we get four people, spend, you know, 10 minutes with each of you on the phone on Skype, we'll be set. So if you want to spend 10 minutes asking us questions, you decide the topic, send us an email, and we will set it up. So let's do it.
Sounds good. And then we got some feedback from John. After listening to you guys discuss the current state of affairs in old school publishing in episode 121 and hearing your incredulous reaction, I thought you guys really should listen to the Dead Robot Society episode 177, Caveat Scriptor, and Let the Writer Beware by Daniel J. Sawyer. Said it would rock our world regarding the dangers of traditional publishing. Also, John assumes, and I think it was Sean just mentioned this, the aforementioned Dragon Page podcast with Michael Stackpole, and he's going on about similar pitfalls in publishing. And he thought, based on our surprise, that in 121, these would be some good recommendations, not only for us, but for listeners as well, to continue talking about some of the dangers that are taking place with traditional publishing.
Do you guys remember what we said? Because I don't remember.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised that we were surprised.
Right.
I was looking back on this, trying to figure out what was said, and I think what John is referring to was perhaps, and I this was news to me when I discovered that agents were doing things that were, you know, well, unethical, borderline illegal, you know. I do remember being incredulous about that. That was news to me. So maybe that's what John is referring to, but I can't remember, and I guess I could listen to the episode to try to figure it out, but I can't remember exactly what was said.
I'd like to listen to that one from J. Daniel Sawyer, though. That sounds like that would be a fun, I don't know about fun, but it sounds like it'd be really interesting to listen to.
Yeah, it may go together nicely with our Christine Catherine Rush interview.
True.
I got the E in there this time. All right, let's wrap this up. The Summer of Sci-Fi Trivia is on, but coming to a close soon. Get your entries in by July 22nd at midnight. Use the article on the homepage to find the trivia questions. We have been getting submissions, so thank you very much to everyone who has entered the contest. But still, you have a good chance to win if you enter. It's not like we've gotten hundreds of submissions yet. So make sure you get yours in. 12 titles on the line. The Summer Fun Drive will end in July. Now, thank you very much to everyone who has donated. Appreciate it very much. But our goal is to raise another $500 by the end of the month. And I know that's a big goal, but I think we can do it. We do have incentives, too. So if you want to get some books in the mail, then come check out the article on the homepage about the Summer Fun Drive to see the different incentive levels. And I am sorry for not getting those books out yet to those of you who have qualified for them. But I haven't forgotten. It's high on my to-do list. And thank you again for everyone who has donated. Does someone want to jump in? I thought I heard someone start to say something.
Sean, I may have that extra incentive. I need to find out. A special little treat that came from the Campbell Conference.
Oh, you might have you.
I will confirm that tomorrow because I didn't actually get to attend the Campbell Conference. I went out of town, but a friend offered to pick up the book and get it autographed from Sir Ian MacDonald.
Okay.
The Campbell Award winning. So I will find out tomorrow from him whether he was that, in fact, able to do that.
So that will be something that Brent and I will discuss then when we figure out. We may have a bonus prize for donators.
Yes.
And if we don't have it, Brent, you are the worst tease in the world.
He's a good, consistent individual, so I would expect that I will have it.
Okay. Okay.
And if not, I will supplement it with something of equal sentimental value.
All right, that works. So, okay, there. In that case, we can announce it then. There will be a bonus prize provided by our very own Brent Bowen for everyone who donates in the Summer Fun Drive. You don't want to miss this, folks. So seriously, thank you everyone who has donated, and thank you, Brent, man, for going out of the way like that to get a special little something-something for our listeners.
And if you guys don't remember, it's like for every – I know it starts off, if you donate 20, you get one book. If you donate $40, you get two books. So it's, you know, pretty nice setup.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I will do my best to not send out, you know, a book three to someone who's only going to get one book. That shouldn't happen because that would really stink. I will be attending Worldcon for 1 day, actually 2 days and one night, it turns out. A friend of mine gave me a place to crash so I could come crash the convention. So if you're going to be there and you want to meet up, we may do a little recording something. And Moses may be there as well. We'll see.
If anyone out there wants to help me stay somewhere in Reno or at Worldcon, then I think maybe I'm there.
Moses needs a room to crash into. And he's very nice. He only takes pictures of you when you're sleeping. So, yeah, if you're going to be at the World Fantasy Convention and you have a place where Moses could crash, I mean...
Worldcon.
Excuse me, yeah, sorry, Worldcon. You're already going to World Fantasy.
Right.
Shoot us an email, adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. But if you're going to be there and you want to meet up, let me know. And if there's some interest, we can do that. And it'll just be fun to hang out for a little bit. Clark's World is going to be giving away 4 copies of their anthologies Realms to our listeners. There's going to be 2 prizes. First place is going to get hard covers of Realms 1 and 2. These are worldwide contests. And second place will get trade paperback copies of Realms 1 and Realms 2. Details for this contest will be coming up in the next few weeks. It will run in August during our birthday month, so don't miss out that. Thank you, Clark's World. And join us on Facebook and Twitter if you want to participate in these contests and win free books. Links on the homepage. All right, next episode, Rachel Kane, right?
Yes.
Guys, do you have anything you wanted to throw in here before we sign off?
My book is coming August 1st. I'm finally getting it out. I'm stoked.
Is that available for pre-order?
Nope. But I am going to do a sale on the ebook the first month. It'll be like $2.99 for the first month, and then it'll go up a buck or two after that. 2 years of hard work, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it only going to be available on Amazon, or are you going to distribute it? Where else are you going to distribute it?
Yeah, it'll be BarnesandNoble.com. I'll get it on iBooks and Smashwords, and then some of the places Smashwords goes out to, like Sony and Kobo also, I'm sure.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to do a big feature with Moses to celebrate this with him and do what we can to support him. So be listening for that soon, guys. And we'll definitely have all the links all over the homepage. So everyone, please go pick out. You know, if you can only do one or the other, buy Moses' book or donate $5 to the show. Forget the show. Buy Moses' book. He deserves it. And you'll get a great book to read, too. So we'll definitely be talking more about that in the next few weeks. All right, that's it then, guys. Thank you very much, and we'll see you all next time.
Thanks, man.
Take care.
Please visit AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com for show notes, videos, reviews, and more, and email us at AdventuresInSciFiPublishing@gmail.com. Some sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at MusicAlley.com. No authors were permanently damaged in the making of this podcast.
Mm-hmm.